Blog Talk Radio.
Leon Vitali, Stanley Kubrick's personal assistant for more than 30 years, an actor in Barry Lyndon.
He was the closest that I ever came to working with a director for film or television, the way that a director worked with actors on stage.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you'd rehearse and rehearse and rehearse and rehearse until he felt that the right emotional temperature and the right feeling of the scene was happening. And how he used to do that very often was, you know, he never knew how he was going to shoot a scene. He just never knew it, you know, how he was going to do it when you walked on set. So he would have you act the scene. But if you thought you were going to sort of just trot your way through a rehearsal, you know, forget it. He'd say, do it the way you think you're going to do it. Do it for real, even in your rehearsal periods, you know, because you may give me a clue as to how I can actually start shooting this scene. You may give me an idea about where to start and what lens to use and how far away to set up, you know, the camera. So you kept on going through that process, and if something wasn't working, you could talk about it and discuss it, and you could say, well, it doesn't feel natural for me to say it this way. And he'd say, well, how would you say it then? And so you'd go through this incredible process. It was like working with a stage director, where for weeks and weeks you will analyze each scene down to the nth degree before you come to an opening night. Whereas with Stanley, you know, if it took a day to get it right, just to shoot that little scene, you'd take a day, and sometimes we took 2 days. It was not uncommon for him, you know, to work that long on one scene. And, mm-hmm. and in actual fact, you know, when you think of Eyes Wide Shut, in Eyes Wide Shut, it was, you know, becoming 7 weeks inside the billiard room and, you know, in the denouement of, you know, Tom Cruise finding out about, you know, what had happened to him, you know,
right.
Especially in that masked ball scene. And, you know, it meant nothing for Stanley to just keep doing it until he felt something interesting was happening that enhanced the thrust of the story.
You can hear more of Leon's interview during the Kubrick series, the Movie Geeks United epic in-depth 8-part series dedicated to the films of Stanley Kubrick, premiering Sunday, December 5th. Visit moviegeeksunited.net for more details. We're on tonight, live, at a special time, 10 p.m. on Sunday.
Aren't we always on live? Unless I'm missing something.
Yeah. feels weird. I feel like Kevin Costner at the end of Waterworld, finally walking on dry land.
There you go, folks. There you go. You get a Waterworld reference tonight. There you go.
Yeah. Might as well open the show with a
bomb. You can't find that everywhere, so.
Yeah. So what's going on? How's your weekend been?
I don't know. A lot of Stanley Kubrick last night, you know? So,
yeah.
Weren't we just here?
I know.
That was great. Yeah, so this weekend was the big Harry Potter weekend, and
yes.
That did, like,
wow.
Yeah, smashingly well, as expected. It was, I think, the highest grossing weekend opening they've had. $330 million worldwide and $125 million this weekend in just our country. Wow.
Oh.
Jeez.
Can you imagine?
Yeah. Wow. That's a lot. Now, it's going to be very curious to see, because these things are awfully front-loaded, but that's incredible. I mean, I don't care who you are. That's a winner.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's just the first of the last two parts.
Yeah.
So imagine how much bigger even the last part will be.
Mm-hmm. And that will probably be in 3D, I would imagine. Because they can do the conversion in time or whatever. So.
Yeah. So how is it?
It's good. It's very good. They get better. They get progressively better. But it's not something you can walk into cold, though. If you've never seen them, or you're not familiar with the story of the books, you are just going to be lost. I mean, at this point, if you haven't watched any, I don't know why you'd want to really come into this now. But it's good though. It's like outside of Love Actually, it's given every British working actor a job. Everybody, and it's amazing. And I'm just really curious now. It leaves you hanging. Like, you really can't wait to see the second half. So, it's good.
Yeah.
So,
is it that kind of ending? Well, no, don't tell me. All right. Almost blew it for everybody. Okay, don't worry about it.
No. It's, let me put it to you like this.
Does it end in a cliffhanger?
No. It ends better. It ends the way you think it's going to end. I mean, it's not like what I told you the other night about, Matrix Reloaded, where it just sort of like they ran out of film, it looked like, or someone put the lens cap on, basically, and they ended it. It's not like that at all. It ends, you know, as everyone knows, it's two parts, and basically it's all, how do I say this? It's like there's stuff happens, but you know, stuff that shit happens, and, but I have given nothing away here, and it's, you will be pleasant. I know there is some, the ending, though, is there's going to be a lot. I'm curious what the reaction will be of this, just this one. It's very emotional. I mean, there's a lot of things going on, so it's good stuff.
Good, good. You know what else is a huge hit, which I know you know, but Inception is a huge hit, and Inception made $810 million worldwide.
That's incredible.
For such an ambitious, original movie, that is an amazing number.
That's I mean, it really is. I kept thinking last night, what if Stanley Kubrick had directed Inception?
I mean, people compare Nolan to Kubrick quite a lot.
Yeah, no, and it's I think it's a valid comparison, no doubt.
The reason why I bring up Inception is because it's a good springboard for Nolan, the success of that, as he's going right into the next Batman movie, The Dark Knight Rises. And Michael Caine revealed.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
They'll start shooting The Dark Knight Rises in May, and they're expecting to receive the screenplay in January as actors. So, so that's that. And then it's busy time for Nolan because Superman starts shooting in June.
That's right. But now he's supervising that. He's like,
right.
How should we say it? He's just like a producer on that. But I'm sure he's going to be watching that every step of the way too. Because I mean, was it Zack Snyder though? I think he can deliver something. I'm curious who they're going to get. Basically, what it is, every young actor in America or every young actor on the planet is being considered for Superman. Yeah, so I'd be curious to see how they do that, who they do pick for that.
And then the Dark Knight Rises will finish shooting in November, and so I'd look for the release July 2012 if they keep on.
Yeah, that's when it is July. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Good
and
time.
And that's going to be quite a month. That July, you're looking at the Spider-Man reboot, the Star Trek 2, which are both in 3D, and then you have Dark Knight Rises at the end of the month. That July alone is just jam-packed right there. That whole year is like supposedly just everything is coming out that year. So,
yeah. So that's exciting. We talked about the the big news in Hollywood last week about the death of the murderer of Ronnie Chase.
Right.
You know, well, they have a couple of more theories about it. And I guess the mayor misspoke to the press and said they're investigating the presumption that it was a possible hit.
Mm-hmm.
Like somebody had it in for her.
Yeah, and I'm just wondering who, though? I mean...
Well, yeah.
You
never know, but...
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you don't know, but she was so well respected and loved by everyone in the community.
Yeah, but the police, like, kind of put the brakes on that and said, look, we're examining all options, but, you know, the hit theory is just one.
Yeah.
We don't have any backing on that kind of
thing. Right, right.
But they do say that... they do believe that she was shot 5 times from a car into her car, probably an SUV, because of the trajectory of the bullets.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, so who knows? But, you know, an incredibly sad loss and a Hollywood kind of murder mystery. So obviously that's what the press is playing up.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Where do you go from there?
Yeah.
Yeah, but Harry Potter did really well, and what's the second place?
Why don't we just like skip over that? I think the other big news is the failure. I mean, this was a risk. I mean, obviously counter programming, but the Russell Crowe movie is a disaster.
Right. Right.
I mean, this is two high-profile disasters for him this year. This and Robin Hood, and while it is smart, you think on paper, okay, this is good to counter Harry Potter, an adult drama, thriller, whatever, however you want to call it, suspense thriller, with Unstoppable out there and. Maybe not so much. Maybe this would have been better to push back or to release earlier.
It probably would have been because I think that's a case where they are competing for the same audience. I think a lot of adults go to Harry Potter and enjoy that too. It's not strictly a kid or young person.
That's
movie,
true. So. That's a very good point. And it's like it's almost sort of sandwiched because you got Faster coming out on, and Love and Other Drugs coming out on Wednesday, so it doesn't really have that much of it. It's just going to get lost in the shuffle.
Well, the big news, too, is there's a lot of ink being written about what happened to Harrison Ford. Because unless he's in an Indiana Jones movie, his films are generally tanking.
Mm-hmm.
We've been
saying that for a couple of years, though, now.
Yeah.
And you just have to look at Hollywood Homicide, K-19 it was okay, but yeah, it is. You're absolutely right. Unless it's an Indiana Jones or a Jack Ryan movie, at that time it does seem like he's not outside the franchise movies that he's known for. He's really not doing well.
Well, I mean, I'm sure he's doing the movies that he wants to do. So, so personally, I'm sure he is. But in terms of audiences going to see a Harrison Ford movie, there doesn't seem to be much interest in seeing him outside of a certain role. But Witness was outside of his norm, and that was a huge success.
I mean, and What Lies Beneath, I think, was 2000. That did very well. That was still when he was, in Air Force One, too. Those are both, big hits for him. I think it's very interesting, though, while he's doing this press junket for Morning Glory, he has been saying that he really wished that Han Solo was killed in Return of the Jedi, as originally stated. So, one of the rumors that's been flying around the Internet the last couple of months is that Lucas is going to announce that he's going to make 7, 8, and 9.
Right.
Well, if Harrison Ford is obviously not going to do it, unless it's something we don't know, unless the price is right. But
yeah, I mean
that rumor going around lately.
Yeah, that rumor pops up every now and then.
I know. But Indiana Jones 5 is happening.
Yeah.
That's a go. So I'm very curious what that's going to be about.
And that'll, of course, be a success. So, but Cowboys and Aliens, the new Jon Favreau movie that Harrison Ford and Daniel Craig star in. The trailer for that appeared last week. And it looks intriguing. I mean, the premise looks like a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's we talked about that a couple of weeks ago. It's been around. That project's been around for a long time, and it's finally, you know, going to be made. And it looks like just a great part for Craig, and it looks like something, a good thing for Harrison Ford to be in. I actually think this would be, this could be like the, a big thing for him, a comeback vehicle, if you would.
Yeah, I think so too. And the movie is about exactly what the title says.
Yeah, I mean, and nothing.
It's that contrast that looks like a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I agree. All right, the new Mike Lee movie.
Sweet.
It's called Another Year. And it's very, very good. Do you know anything about Mike Lee's process?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. He's very, I don't know, like, his process, but he does seem to get the best out of his actors, and he's, I mean, probably some of the best films about British working class that I've seen, but his process, I don't know. I don't know his process.
Well, it's interesting because when he starts a movie, he doesn't know what he wants it to be. He hasn't written anything. He doesn't know the plot. He doesn't know anything. And he just approaches actors here and there, and they build it.
So is a lot of improvising on the set?
No, apparently not. I mean, these interviews will elucidate what we're talking about here. But it's a very unique way of working, and it produces really unique films. And Another Year, I think, is one of his best, and
okay,
one of the
cool,
very best of the year. It is a very funny, emotional, uncomfortable. I mean, it's everything rolled into one, and audiences apparently have very different reactions to it. And a big front runner now for Best Actress, Best Supporting. There's a lot of talk about Leslie Manville in this film, and she gives a phenomenal standout performance in it. And the movie is also anchored by a brilliant performance from Jim Broadbent, and we all know Jim Broadbent from, you know, we talked about Indiana Jones. He's in Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. He's in the new Harry Potter.
He's all over the place.
He's a great actor, and I think most people recognize him and remember him from Moulin Rouge, among you know, most audiences nowadays. But he won his Oscar for Iris.
Right.
Opposite Kate Winslet, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Dame Judi Dench.
Yes. Jim Broadbent plays Tom in the movie, and he's married to a character named Jerry, and they're a very happy, confident, comfortable couple, and kind of madness and stress and chaos surrounds them among their circle of friends, led by Leslie Manville's character, Mary, who is traumatized by an unfortunate life and even more unfortunate relationships. So that's the basis for our interviews. These two interviews were done separately, but they're edited together, just to give you guys some context here. Bring up my switchboard on my slow computer so I can play,
right, okay,
play this interview. It's going to happen, I'm pretty sure.
Okay.
Here we go. Here is Jim Broadbent and Leslie Manville talking about Mike Lee's Another Year.
Don't do your back in.
I know. Doesn't get any easier. Job for a younger man, this.
What?
Mum, Dad, this is Katie.
Hello.
This is Tom and
Hi.
Jerry.
Hello.
Tom and Jerry, that's brilliant. This is for you, Tom.
Ah, Buenos Aires.
Yeah, because I thought, but well, you went there, didn't you, the two of you, Argentina?
No, I didn't, no.
Didn't you?
Eat, drink, be merry. That's not enough.
Life's not always kind, is it?
What are we going to do with you then, eh? Can't go on like this, that's for sure.
As long as we're friends, then I'm all right.
knew you were going to do that.
You've worked with Mike Lee over the past 30-some-odd years, I think.
Yes, yeah.
And he has a very unique process, and I wanted you to tell me about that process. When he comes to you with another year, what does he come with?
He comes with nothing, believe it or not. He literally says, do you want to be in my film? And the answer is yes or no, because although he might have ideas and notions and themes that he wants to deal with in the film, he doesn't have a story or a script, and he certainly doesn't have any characters, because that's what he does with us individually when we start. In the case of another year, we spend 18 weeks before we started shooting, literally working one-to-one, creating the characters over a very extensive period of time, and then eventually meeting other characters that your character would know, and then eventually doing some improvisations that finally will be honed down and dramatized and pinned down in terms of dialogue and will become the film. I mean, we don't ever improvise on camera, but we do a lot of improvisation to get to the point where there is a kind of dramatic narrative to the film.
Mm. So once you're shooting,
mm.
you know where it's going for the most
no,
part?
No, we don't. We're sort of doing it pretty much chronologically when we shoot it, and we kind of roughly know where we're going, but only in a very thumbnail sketch kind of way. I mean, when we started shooting, we knew that the film was going to cover four seasons, but really the outline that we have is very scant, and what we do is we work for a few days and structure scenes and absolutely nail down the dialogue, and then the crew come and we shoot it, and then the crew go away for a few more days and we work out the next bit. And but because you're dealing with these characters' lives and obviously it needs to be done chronologically, you don't really know the next bit until you've got there, if you know what I mean. You don't know what's going to happen
mm-hmm.
in winter until you've done the spring, summer and autumn bits. Because one thing feeds the other, if you know what I mean.
And I said, do you know what it's going to be about this time? He said, no, I'm not. I don't. And at this stage, I don't know who else is going to be in it, and I don't know what it's going to be about. And if I haven't got anything particularly in mind, and he'll. So then I have to decide whether I want to do it, and I say yes, eventually.
yeah.
And that is the classic way he works, really. I mean, and then the other cast becomes clear, it's obvious that a lot of the cast members are round about my age, and so that is obviously he's got something in mind in just in terms of the age of the cast. But other than that, I don't know anything else. And I don't know what I'm going to be playing, who I'm going to be married to in the film, or who related to, or anything. So, and then it just develops from there, from a blank sheet of paper.
So it sounds like the ultimate freedom as an actor, because you're able to craft whatever kind of character that you want.
No, he oversees it all very. It's a very sort of structured way of working, and he oversees every aspect of it, development of each character in meticulously. In a one-to-one thing with him, you build up the character from nothing, and decide where the character's from, where he was born, what his social class he's in, and what his family is, and then you start working with other actors. And in this case, with first person, other actor I worked with was David Bradley, who plays Tom's brother, Ronnie. So we started building up their shared history. So it's a very precise and painstaking way of working. And it's 5 months of developing your character and the character's friends and relations and relationships. 5 months before you see a camera. So it's a very painstaking and very structured way of working. So it's not ultimate freedom as such. You don't just get up and improvise and play around. It's you meticulously build up the character and research the character and discuss with the other actors as appropriately what their shared history is, and until you build up a whole fictional world, really.
It's very liberating if you like improvising and you love all that freedom of creating a character. And it's very involving. I mean, he absolutely needs you. He can't do it without you. And you know that you're going to go on this journey, that he's going to ask you to play somebody that's not like you and not like anything you've done with him before. And you're going to be called upon to be very involved and very creative, and it's great to be such a major part of something. It's not just the usual case of, you know, a script turns up, you read it, you say yes, you'll do it, and you learn the lines and you go there and you pretty much have to get it together by yourself and do it. This way of working, it's very, very collaborative, and he absolutely needs the actors to work with him.
And from a cinematic point of view, he seems to be very patient. I mean, he lets the scenes play out, so it feels like the closest you can get to the feeling of theater on film, in a way.
Yes, I think, yeah, quite a few people say that. I mean, I love the way he shoots things. I love some of the shots that he does with his Dick Pope, his cinematographer. It is about just allowing what's going on with the characters to be the most important thing. And the camera seems to always serve that very well. And yes, and he often lets a scene carry on beyond what may be a natural point to end it. And I like that very much.
Now, Tom and his wife, Jerry, in the film, they seem to be the calm in the middle of, you know, the emotional storm of their friends, of the people that they relate to in life. What do you kind of attribute that to? Do you think luck plays a major part in determining that kind of relationship? Or,
yeah, I think they're both lucky. They're both they've both been, I think, genetically lucky. They're both intelligent and balanced, and have a fairly wise outlook on life. They know how to use their skills, and both of them come from working class backgrounds, and are the first people in their family to have gone into further education. But they seem to know. They seem to instinctively know how to handle it, and they find each other, and soulmates very easily. And I think they are lucky, and they know they're lucky, I think, and they're both fulfilled professionally, and I think they feel some sort of obligation to let their less fortunate friends into their lives as and when they appear.
Do you feel that the film is ultimately optimistic about relationships, or just realistic about
it? I think it's sort of, yeah, I think it's, I don't know really. I think it's probably just sort of realistic in a way, but it's I think all those things are, it's up to the, I think it's been clear from the screenings and the reviews that people, the audience, take very varied reactions to it, and I mean, and to characters. I've had people say to me that they think Tom and Jerry are wonderful, and they'd like them to be their friends. And I've had other people say that find Tom and Jerry self-satisfied and smug and somewhat insular, or, you know. And I think that's all equally valid. You know, I think that's what's rather exciting about the film. The audience takes from it what a very particular, their own particular reactions, which is all equally valid, as with our friends, we're often you see people and say, I don't trust that guy. And my wife will say, what do you mean? He's wonderful. You know, we have different opinions. And I think that's the whole, with the whole film, it's like that. I think it could be seen as optimistic and could be seen as rather bleak and pessimistic. But it's certainly nice, I think, to see a happy marriage on the screen, which is fairly unusual in this day and age.
I think the film tells it as it is, and I think there is definitely optimism in it, and I think there is also pessimism in it. I think that it's a film that people could watch and maybe change their lives a bit, brace themselves and change their lives to perhaps avoid being what they might see in some of the characters in the film. And I think that there might be some people that view it and feel envious. And there's so much to take from it. There really is so much to take from it.
Mary, your character in the piece, it seems, I mean, she's kind of like an open wound of
yes.
a character. And
yes.
What's it like being in that place for that period of time?
Well, it's fine, actually, because I'm not one of those people who gets hung up or takes it home with me. You know, I mean, obviously, I'm not saying she was easy to play, and I'm not saying it wasn't demanding, and I'm not saying that I didn't have to go to some pretty deep emotional depths to play her, but I do have the ability to kind of, you know, brush it off at the end of the day and go home and have a nice time. So, and I think that's part of the discipline that Mike encourages, because I think by the time you've been creating a character for 18 weeks or so, and then you start to shoot it for like another 11 or 12 weeks, you're very used to the discipline of kind of going in character and coming out of character. You get very adept at it. And but I think I'm just one of those actors who doesn't carry characters around in that way. I mean, obviously, I'm always, when I'm creating somebody, I'm always thinking about them and, you know, how they might be in about certain situations or whatever, but I don't emotionally take it home with me. So I didn't go through a particularly depressed time when I was playing Mary at all.
There's a scene in the film, a long scene that you have with Tom's older brother.
Oh yes, yes.
And it's one of my favorite moments in the film, and I'm wondering if you could talk about your approach to it, because for me it works on several different levels. I mean, it's in a way it's very funny because his character is so kind of monosyllabic.
Yes, yeah.
And it makes it uncomfortable as well, but also very heartbreaking because
yes.
Mary is clearly so starved for companionship and some kind of connection to someone.
That's right. That's right. Well, I mean, obviously, you know, Mike and I had worked on the particular state of mind that Mary was going to be in, given that Jerry is kind of not happy with her because of the way Mary behaved towards her son's girlfriend. So that sort of sets up that there's this kind of there's a slightly frozen atmosphere between Jerry and Mary, which of course gives Mary a lot of grief because Jerry is a big thing in Mary's life and she feels quite maternally towards her. So that established, and then you put on top of that this, you know, her car's gone wrong and it's been towed away and she's drunk this bottle of champagne on her own all night. She's just had a terrible, terrible night. And she's got up, no makeup, no hair, tracksuit bottoms on, and gone round to Tom and Jerry to sort of try and say, you know, I'm whatever she's going round to try and say, but to make things better. And she gets there and Tom and Jerry are not there, and this person who she doesn't know is there. And obviously, and when we did the initial improvisation for that scene, obviously I had no idea that the door was going to be answered by David Bradley's character. So having put Mary in this really stripped down version of herself where quite clearly, as soon as you see her, you know that she's in a state, the scene kind of, you know, rather wonderfully, the first time we improvised it, went off instinctively to this place where these two lonely souls kind of kind of came together and, you know, had, oddly enough, you know, somebody that Mary didn't know at all, this virtual stranger, she sort of manages to talk to in a way that you haven't seen her able to talk to anybody else in the film.
Yeah.
And she really does offer the hand of friendship to Ronnie. It's certainly not, I mean, some people have said, oh, do we think they're going to try and get together? No, it's nothing like that at all. It's just, you know, she sees that he's lonely, that he's just lost his wife, and, you know, she sees this other lonely, lonely soul and just tries to reach out for it a bit, meanwhile getting some kind of solace for her own particular situation. But I agree with you. I think it's a really touching, very poignant, touching scene,
mm-hmm.
And which has, you know, amidst all of the pain of it, there are some real, very, very funny moments.
I mean, not least of all,
later on when she's lying down on the sofa and she says, it's so nice to have somebody to talk to, and it cuts to a shot of him sort of sitting there pretty gormless and speechless, and, you know, it's the irony of it, it's just so beautifully observed, you know.
For Mary, because if you contrast that with Tom and Jerry in the film, who are obviously a very comfortable, confident, happy couple.
Yes.
Why do you think Mary's been plagued with loneliness in her life? Is she not receptive to that kind of relationship, do you
think?
Well,
I think that, I mean, for me, what the film is saying is that that kind of stuff in life is quite random, that you can have it or not have it. And, you know, Mary has, lots of stuff has happened to Mary that you, the viewer, never get to know about. I mean, she's had a terrible childhood. She was abandoned by her father, never knew her father. And then her mother eventually abandoned her. She had a terrible time at school, didn't make friends easily. She had a catalogue of disastrous, abusive relationships. Life has just handed her a very, very bad deal. But I think that you might disagree, but I think the film is sort of saying that there's not a lot you can do to shift that. I mean, Mary is not a bad person. She's at times misguided, and at times she behaves inappropriately, and at times she's a bit too much to handle, but she's not a bad person. But she's had a very, very hard life, and she's had love given to her and then cruelly taken away from her, and it's left her very bruised and bitter. Whereas Jerry and Tom, they've had none of those struggles in their life. They met at university, they've been in love, and they've been soulmates ever since then. They are going to go to their graves knowing that they had somebody in their life that meant everything to them. And Mary, and indeed Ken, Mary and Ken are the complete reverse of that. And, you know, how many times do you meet people or know people or maybe feel it about yourself that you think, I've been unlucky in because of this. And, I think luck does sort of come into it, but it's a cruel blow to have to swallow that, you know, you somehow or other your life just never seems to quite be what you want it to be. And you know, the major comment that I get about Mary is that people say to me is, oh my God, we all know somebody like Mary, or we know somebody with aspects of Mary. And a lot of people have said to me, I feel that I'm a bit like Mary, or I've been like Mary at certain points of my life. So, yeah, I think it's a kind of, the film touches people on all sorts of different levels, and they make of it what they want. I mean, there are people that don't kind of revel in the lovely relationship that Jerry and Tom have. Some people feel that they're a bit self-satisfied and a bit smug, and some people feel very strongly for Mary and get very emotional talking about Mary. Some people feel she's irritating and is her own worst enemy. And I think that's good to have that diverse people having that kind of those diverse opinions about the film is good, because it's, yes, the film is British, but it's not a kind of social documentary. It is by default British because it's made by Mike Lee and we're all British in it, but the film is dealing with heart and soul and what makes people tick. So all of that is universal. The end of the film, which obviously I don't want to talk about too much because you might have people listening who haven't seen it yet, but the end of the film
right.
very, very much leaves you wondering what's going to happen to not just Mary, but to lots of other characters. And I think that's great. We don't want neatly tied up happy endings all the time. And anyway, how many of us, our lives are ongoing, aren't they? And our problems don't always get sorted out. We can even go to our graves and our problems are not sorted out and everything isn't tied up neatly.
Yeah, I think the 5 months we spend developing the character is, I mean, ideally, you know, you get a richer, more complicated and more many-faceted character than you very often do in a normal scripted film. And not always the case. There's some, obviously, there's some fantastic writers and directors who work in a traditional way. But the advantage of this is that you do tend to get a different sort of characters, perhaps.
Well, particularly given the process that you utilize to put these films together with Mr. Lee, when you finally watched the film with an audience in finished form, did anything surprise you about the film?
Yeah, when you watch it with an audience, yes, I mean, things surprise you that there are laughs that you just never expected. You weren't looking for at all. But I mean, when you see them through with an audience. You suddenly see it through an audience's eyes, and you think, yeah, that is actually very funny, or conversely, that is very moving, and I hadn't really spotted that. But he and Dick Pope, the cameraman, had spotted it in some some way and had observed it and made sure that it's there for the audience. So there are surprises, yes.
You've been involved in so many films I'm crazy about, and I know our listeners are certainly crazy about. And one question I had about some of your other work is that you ventured into films like Harry Potter, Narnia, Indiana Jones. Do you find that you're being approached by kind of a different demographic fan-wise after you've done that work in those films?
It really amounts to what photos people send through to get signed for autographs, and certainly those films, particularly Harry Potter, is overwhelmingly the majority of the fan mail I get, really. And in terms of getting recognised in the street or something, it doesn't change a great deal. I think it's never been a problem or a hindrance to life. Really, it's always very pleasant. You know?
You've worked with some of the great filmmakers, and Mr. Lee is certainly the tops. But I wanted to get your impressions of just a couple of others that you've worked with. And what they give you as an actor that's unique for them, like Baz Luhrmann, who you've had very successful collaboration with.
Yeah, that was wonderful. I mean, they've all got all the directors, and Baz Luhrmann, Woody Allen, and Martin Scorsese, and all. I mean, they've all got a huge amount in common in that they care enormously about their work, and Baz was a particular example of that. And he really did have a huge vision for the for Moulin Rouge, which he was hugely energetic and impressive in reaching out for that vision to get it on the screen. So that, and that, and that's always it's demanding and satisfying for the actor in equal measure. You know, you're very relieved, and then when directors don't settle for second best, but it doesn't make it any easier for us particularly. But that's what you always look for in somebody who's really going to push the envelope, as it were.
And in that film, it's such a unique tone in that film, and a special energy. When I watched Moulin Rouge, obviously, and I've seen it many times now, it's one of my favorites, I was drawn to it because I'd never seen that movie before. Are you surprised when you saw that film? I mean, did you know that that's what you were a part of, that the tone and the energy of it?
It felt like that very much when we were doing it, because certainly, I mean, Baz was pushing me to be bigger and bolder and braver and louder and more extrovert and all the way. And then I think halfway through shooting, I think Christmas came and we had a break, and we were shown a sort of 20-minute edited sequence of the work so far. Which was a brilliant thing to do, because that was then we very much knew the style of the piece that he was working on, and we were all working on. So by seeing the final result, which was wonderful, but we had been sort of had indications of which way it was going beforehand. But it was, as you're right, you know, there is an extraordinary energy and originality. I think it was rather overlooked somehow. I don't know quite how it got overlooked in the awards season the way it did. I think it should have been much more lauded.
My last question for you, because you've been performing for a while, and you've had so many tremendous experiences with great collaborators and great films. Does acting mean something different to you now in this stage of your career than it did when you were starting?
Inevitably a bit, because you've got the experience of doing all sorts of different things, and I never like to repeat myself, so I'm always looking for new experiences, and it gets harder in many ways to find things I haven't done before, but it's still the initial impetus of wanting to act is the same, and the journey in trying to make whatever it is sound real and natural and engage an audience is exactly as it ever was.
What about these two then, Mary?
Such a surprise.
This monster hid this young lady behind the sitting room door.
Made me jump.
Yeah, poor Tom. I thought I was going to give him a heart attack.
She passed the test.
I'm surprised you passed the test. I'd have got rid of you on the spot. Terrible way to treat someone.
Yeah.
We had absolutely no idea.
This is my big secret.
Well, thanks very much.
It's obviously serious.
Still, it's been really good to meet you both, though. And we had a lovely lunch.
You didn't say you're having lunch, Jerry.
We have lunch every day.
Yeah, I know you have lunch every day, Joe.
Bread and cheese.
Nothing special.
I thought it was special. We had some tomatoes from Tom and Jerry's allotment. Have you tasted them?
Yeah, loads of times. Jerry's always giving me stuff from the allotment, aren't you, Jerry?
I'll give you some to take home, Mary.
Oh, great.
Okay, those are actors Jim Broadbent and Leslie Manville. The movie is Another Year. It's the new Mike Leigh film. It opens up December 31st in limited release, New York and L.A., and expect to see a lot of it come awards season as well, as is usual with Mike Leigh movies.
Yeah, this is a really good interview. Wow. I could listen to them for hours. That was great. No, I love listening to them, so it was really good.
Yeah. A couple of announcements. One of the big DVD releases this year, or this season.
Mm-hmm.
Jerry, did you ever get into Nip Tuck?
No, I never did. Everyone else I know loved it. I never really watched it.
Yeah.
It's a big release. Is this the whole series?
Yeah, the whole series is available now in this this huge box set. I believe it's eight seasons in here.
Oh, my, eight seasons? That was on for 8 seasons?
Yeah, yeah.
God, my life is going before my eyes.
Ryan Murphy created the show.
Mm-hmm, that's right. Wow, he's
just
a gold mine.
Yeah, wildly popular. But that box set is available now. It's a great holiday gift for anybody that likes that series that you know of. And you can purchase it here on our homepage by clicking that icon.
Oh,
and you
cool.
can also purchase it on our website, moviegeeksunited.net/media.
Sweet.
And it's available there as well. Another announcement involves the Chronicles of Narnia. This is a
great
cause.
Yeah, they made a third one, and it's in 3D. What a shock.
Yeah, it comes out.
I do want to see it, though. I am curious. I've seen the other two, so I am very curious about this one.
See, I have not actually seen the other two, but I've seen they showed us 25 minutes of the new one before Unstoppable. So that's all I've seen of Narnia, really. And, you know, obviously a wildly popular
right. Wow,
series
they just
of books
25 minutes of it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Like special, and a lot of the footage was to kind of show off the effect scenes in it. A couple of the effects are really kind of breathtaking.
Okay, wow. But this is just various scenes. It wasn't like the first 25 minutes of the movie.
No.
Okay, I was going to say, cool.
It's the strangest thing, because I remember going to an exhibitor screening of, I can't remember the film, I think it was Mulan, years and years ago.
Right.
And before Mulan, they said Michael Bay has made a special edit of Armageddon for you guys to watch, you know, 5 months ahead of time. So we're very excited.
Yeah.
So they showed us like 45 minutes of Armageddon, and it was basically edited to show you the whole track of the story. And gosh, I much preferred that. It was very emotional, and I much preferred that 45-minute
version
of Armageddon.
Full length, right.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of loses something when you tack on an hour and a half. But anyway, so Narnia comes out in December. I believe December 10th is the release date for that one. And here's a great promotion that they have for it in connection to the release of it. 20th Century Fox and Walden Media, in association with Operation Christmas Child and Regal Cinemas, is doing an Operation Narnia hometown premiere challenge. And this is how it works. For the first time ever, Operation Christmas Child has partnered with a motion picture event in a global effort that will bring Christmas to needy children throughout the world. Now, Operation Christmas Child is a project. It's the world's largest Christmas project that hand-delivers gift boxes in over 130 countries to more than 77 million children. And for many, these are the first presents that they've ever encountered.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Great.
And Narnia is making it possible for you to join in as our listeners. The group that put, if you go to OperationNarnia.com, it'll give you full details on how you can join the effort. The group that puts together the most gift boxes will win a special hometown premiere of the film provided by Regal Cinemas. So wherever your local Regal Cinemas is, if your area and your contribution makes it to the winner's circle in this contest, they'll premiere the film in your town.
Wow.
And the two of the film stars, Georgie Henley and Skander... I don't know the film. I'm terrible. Georgie and Skander, they'll both attend the event. The actors that portray Lucy and Edmund in the film.
Right, okay, yeah, all right.
Keens, I think, is Skander's last name. So go to OperationNarnia.com for more details of that, and that's the information on that. And you're typing it in right now.
No, I'm not. I'm not typing it in. But, no, that's awesome, though. That's great that they're doing that. That's a really worthwhile, definitely good thing to be doing.
Yeah. Also, our Kubrick series.
Oh, yeah. Here we go.
Yeah. We're giving thought to staggering the episodes because it's too enormous, and we're constantly getting in more guests, and we want to make it as big and bold and comprehensive as possible for Kubrick fans out there. So we're thinking of doing the episodes once every 2 weeks. which means that it's going to be a series that continues over the course of 4 months.
Right, yeah.
That being said, we're still premiering the first episode December 5th, Sunday, and we will air Matthew Modine's interview uncut on Friday the 10th, even though his episode of Full Metal Jacket will not be aired in its entirety until later on, probably we're looking at February.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
But we haven't firmed that up yet. I just want to give an update. But go to MovieGeeksUnited.net for the latest updates on that. And we're adding guests every day. We just got James B. Harris, and he's going to play a big part of that first episode. He's the producer of The Killing, Paths of Glory, and Lolita. So he was a major figure in Kubrick's early career and a very close friend of Kubrick. So that's an interesting conversation.
Right, right. No, I mean, that's an enormous get. I mean, that's just incredible. I mean, that's just a wealth of just information and history right there. I mean,
yeah. Yeah, he was. And I told him I loved that we loved Cop.
Right.
I talk about Cop to friends all the time. He was like, really? I said, yeah. The James Woods movie, Cop. I mean, yeah.
Based on a James Ellroy book, Killer on the Road.
Yeah.
Great book, yeah.
And I believe the new movie that he's working on is based on Ellroy, possibly. He's trying to get a new movie off the ground called No Rest for the Dead. It seems like a kind of a hard-boiled
I'll have to look into
story
that.
In that vein, at least. And that was an interesting conversation, though. The three movie geeks.
Three movie geeks. I know where you're going with that.
Had last night about Kubrick. I mean, that was great.
Yeah, it was. It was phenomenal.
So we can't wait to share this with you guys. Anything else new going on?
That's really, dude, we talked about everything so far since that's happened since the last show. And we're going to be back Wednesday night.
Yes. With Mina Savari, who's in a new movie called Hemingway's Garden of Eden.
Interesting. Wow.
Yeah, with Katerina. I have her last Molino, who actually, I mean, gosh, they're both so beautiful. And when I talk to beautiful women, I notice, my voice goes up like an octave, and I laugh a lot more than I should probably.
That's all right, dude. That's cool.
But both of them are staggeringly beautiful and staggeringly good in this new movie, and it's something that they're very proud of. And Katerina was actually the Bond girl in Casino Royale with Daniel Craig. That's how American audiences know of her. So
right.
That'll be coming up on Wednesday night. So let's close the show with our last interview, and then
okay.
we'll be off until Wednesday.
Okay, cool.
Jerome Elston Scott, there's a new film called Anderson's Cross that Jerome Elston Scott, who's a very talented up-and-coming talent. Man, that was redundant. That he acts in, he wrote it, he directed it, he produces it. I'm pretty sure he does the catering for it as well. I mean, if anybody multitasks, it's this guy, and it's really impressive. Anderson's Cross has been receiving raves from festival audiences across the country, and everyone that's seen it has fallen in love with it. It is available now on DVD. You can actually purchase it on Amazon starting the 22nd, which is tomorrow. And this conversation is a great insight into the journey from wanting to be an actor, of having that dream and actually making it a reality, making the move to L.A., the connections that you make to make that happen.
Right.
And, you know, mounting a project from scratch and making it become a reality. It's a very inspiring story from Jerome.
Mm-hmm.
So we will close off the night with this interview. Jerry, thank you very much.
Oh, no, thank you. It was a lot of fun, and we'll see everyone on Wednesday night.
All righty. Thank you, guys. Here's Jerome.
Nicholas Anderson.
Trevor McCarthy.
250 days a year, 8 hours a day. Elementary school, junior high, high school. I figure it's about time we say hi to each other.
Hi.
Hey. You skate?
No.
Come on, it's pretty easy. I could teach you. I mean, if you ever want to learn. I mean, not right now, but, you know, some other time.
Yeah.
Maybe some other time. So, I was noticing you didn't get a good grade on Mr. Cameron's test.
You noticed that?
Yeah. You having trouble with it?
I just didn't study.
Well, I mean, you know, if you ever need help, I could help. All I have to do is ask. I can come by your house. We can study. It's not a big deal.
Sure.
Before we get into the movie, tell me a little bit about your background and how you kind of caught the bug and you knew that performing and writing and directing in films was something that you wanted to do with your life. How did that start for you?
Wow. You know, it's funny. I've been thinking about this lately because I was in the third grade and I had my best friend at the time was we had a school play and they were gonna do the Wizard of Oz, and he wanted to play the Cowardly Lion, and suddenly he just became obsessed with just learning all the lines, and we were watching the Wizard of Oz on tape over and over, and he was practicing every day, and I was very much into like action figures and superheroes, and that's what we normally did, but he just was into this. And so we went to finally go where he's going to the audition, and he froze up. And so I'm there trying to teach him, you know, you remember you were doing this, and remember it was just like you practiced and this and that, and the teacher saw me doing that and was like, I think you should audition. And so I went up and auditioned. The only reason I knew it was because we have just been doing this for weeks. And I was so glad that the audition was coming up and it was going to be over so we could get back to, you know, playing Superman and Batman. And, you know, and I auditioned for it, and she liked it, and we were never friends since. It just was my first moment, you know, entry into just acting. I had never sort of done it before. And then they basically had to drag me off of that stage after you know, just the camaraderie of putting together, you know, a show, even at that young age, even in a school production, you got out of class. You got to go and hang out and sing and dance, and you know, and all the girls liked to, and it was just great, and I just loved it. And then, you know, and then when we got to the whole applause thing, that was just, I was just sort of bitten by it.
Yeah,
you know?
It's addictive. It's addictive for sure.
It really
is. But you knew that that's kind of where you belonged. I mean, you felt like
absolutely,
you belonged there.
Absolutely. Just the moment that I was able to do it, I had never felt that kind of feeling for anything. Everyone else wanted to be firemen and, you know, and doctors and policemen. I never wanted to do any of those things, you know. Mm-hmm. I was either going to be, you know, Superman or Jimmy Stewart. One or the other.
That's pretty good. Either way, that's a pretty lofty ambition. That's pretty good.
Right, exactly. So it was a lot of fun, and yeah, that's what happened.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in New Jersey, and then I went to school performing arts in Washington and also in Florida. So I moved around a lot, Orlando and stuff like that. But Jersey is where I started. And then I really kind of learned my craft when I went to school in Washington D.C. I went to audition for the School of Performing Arts in New York, but I missed the auditions. They do a series of them, and I had only hit the last one, and they suggested that I go to the one in Washington because they're all sort of connected, and I went and I auditioned for them because they were just beginning, and then I got into there, and that was sort of where it started, you know.
So how did you get to California? Because I mean, you've been doing this for a long time. So where does that journey come in?
You know, and it's funny because I was at Universal, and they have what you call a lead. They do like a thing where you're a lead, and you make like a dollar more an hour, and you get to sort of tell everybody sort of what to do. And I got passed over for that job, and I was very upset. And I was like, what? And I remember my mother said to me, you know, I thought you wanted to be an actor. What is this? You want to be a lead at a ride show? And it just kind of clicked for me.
Yeah.
And they had done a movie called Rosewood, and I was an extra in that. And I got to speak to John Voight. And and I was like, oh, you know, I want to be an actor. And he's like, what are you doing here? You need to go to L.A. You need to go to California.
John Voight and, told you
know,
that?
Yes. And, wow. And for me, I was like, well, you know, John Voight said, go, you know, I'll go. And even then it took a while, you know, and I gathered up a couple of friends and, you know, and came down just blindly. You have to do it not knowing what's in store for you. You know, you have to be that naive to be like, I'm going to put myself in the car and I'm going to drive down and I'm going to be a star. I'm going to make, you know, make it as an actor. And so, you know, I drove down and I actually got sort of, I don't know if you want to call it discovered, but the day I got here, we were hanging out. We were trying to find a place to live because we came here without a place to live. And my friends were getting a little depressed because we weren't getting anyone to call us back. And so we went to the mall and we were in the food court and I was trying to cheer everybody up and be silly. And a guy came up to me and was just like, you know, are you an actor? I was like, yes. That's exactly what I'm here for. Here's my card. Come down to the set. Da-da-da, you know, and within days I was on Lethal Weapon 4.
And, yeah, I see that here in your resume. That's amazing. Within days of being in L.A. Huh.
Even days. It doesn't always happen that way, okay? But for me, that's how it happened. And, you know, and even then, after I did it, I was still... Then I was back to, okay, now what am I going to do?
So you had, when you went up there, your goal was to be a working actor. You didn't have in mind that you wanted to do your own films necessarily?
No, I didn't. I had dabbled with, you know, friends and things like that in making films and things like that. But they never sort of came to fruition because you can't. You have to. People are like, oh, I'm going to come and be in your little film, and then they don't show up, and you're not paying them. And, you know, those things had never sort of worked out for me. But I was getting a lot of work just sort of day player and a spot here or a line here or featured there. But I wasn't moving beyond that, and I wanted a career. I felt like, well, I could do this and, you know, earn a living and just work. But that wasn't really what I wanted to do. I wanted to have a career, and I just felt like there were not any roles that were there for me. Even though, you know, I was going out for things, there were just things that just weren't there that were going to push me to having any sort of a career. So I just decided, hey, I think I'll try my hand at this and see if I can, you know, fail.
Well, create, you know, yeah, and create your own create your own opportunities. I mean, if you can't find the role, write it. You know,
write it exactly. And, you know, I think it really sort of depends on your upbringing. You know, there comes a time when your parents get tired of you complaining. They're like, stop complaining and do something about it.
Yeah,
you know, and
yeah.
So and that was it. And I was also on a lot of sets that. Where there was a lot of self-empowerment, you know, people that are huge now but really work themselves up from the bootstraps and, you know, Judd Apatow. And those guys they worked and they had good work and they created good work. You know, they were writing and directing and they weren't always appreciated, but the work was really good. And it's great to see them be appreciated now, you know.
Yeah.
But I got to sit on those sets and watch and learn and talk and speak up, and you know, it's the kind of set that I tried to emulate, where, you know, people are able to speak up and you have a good atmosphere because it's supposed to be fun.
Exactly. But you know, all this experience that you had prior to directing Anderson's Cross and writing it and performing in it, I mean, it allowed you to observe the people that you're working for behind the camera, and it made you comfortable on screen, I'm sure. With that in mind, what was the biggest biggest challenge or the biggest learning curve involved in writing and directing your own script?
Just being in charge, like, and being and finally hitting that thing about whether or not you really actually could do it. Overcoming that was kind of the biggest thing of where it sort of stops. You know, in all of my other situations, there was always someone else that it could go to. You know, the final decisions didn't necessarily rest on me. You know, but when you are sort of representing everyone, you have a commitment to the actors, you have a commitment to the crew, you have a commitment to the locations, you have a commitment to the investors, you have a commitment to, you know, and to the story. That was probably sort of the hardest thing of just saying, okay, how do I keep everyone happy so that they continue to want to move forward and help the project move forward? And also feel like I have a voice and I have something to contribute. That was kind of, I think, the hardest thing, just figuring out that I could do it and having that moment. Because, you know, every time you show up on a set or everything, I think it just becomes this thing of, like, I'm not going to be able to do this. You know, for me, directing Anderson's Cross in the beginning, well, all through it was all about, well, this is the day they find me out. This is the day they realize I don't know what I'm doing. Okay? So, you know, I was literally, like, exhausted every day because I was just like, wow, the entire thing was a performance. Okay, you don't know what you're doing. And it just becomes a thing of trying to put it all together. But then you realize you do know.
Yeah.
You know, and to know that your instincts are there. But doubt sets in, and I don't think I would have it any other way. I certainly wouldn't want to show up and think I know everything. You
right.
know, it's just, even the thing that I wrote, there was a scene in the movie that I wrote that we auditioned everyone in. And it was just, I thought, just a great piece of writing. And that's what we had people audition with. It's not even in the movie. We never even shot it. You know, it became this thing of, like, it read well. And it allowed me to see people's talent during the audition process. But it did not film well. It didn't have a place in the movie. You know, and so for me, I had to just realize that and say, you know, you don't know everything. This thing that everyone loved so much as a writing exercise is not even in the movie. So
yeah, that's something that I hear a lot, that you know, you're very close to it, you're intimate, you've lived with that script for a long time, but when it comes to the actual production, and particularly the post-production of it, you can't be too precious about any particular moments because they might not serve the whole in the end.
Right. There was our DP used to have a saying called happy mistakes, and that's really what it is. There are a lot of happy mistakes in the movie, and people love the shot of the Nick character standing on top of the Winnebago. You know, I wasn't originally supposed to be on top of the Winnebago. I was going to be in the Winnebago, but I went up there because we were going to do a crane shot, and I needed to see what was going on and what we were actually going to see. And everyone was like, oh, that's going to look great. That's So for me, I had to listen. I'm like, everyone is talking about how great this looks. Maybe this should go in the movie. This isn't something that we should be sharing with just the crew.
Mm-hmm.
This should go, you know, we've got to change it. We've got to put it up there. No one said anything about a great shot when I was sitting in the Winnebago. And so, you know, it's just those are the types of things.
Well, and the different kind of personality traits that you need as a writer and a director, too, because if you're writing a screenplay on your own, I mean, it's about solitude, and you've got to be comfortable with that process. But directing is all about collaboration. So do you find that you're equally adept at both?
Yes, I do. This whole process is still very surreal for me, like talking about me. yes, I feel like I'm equally adept at both. It just sounds so weird. You know, I could just see my brothers and sisters like listening to this going, oh my God. I do. I think I'm like a sponge. I really want everyone's input. And the thing is, you know, when you cast these people or you hire them, it's because you like some of the same things. At least that was what what I did. You know, I wanted a DP that had some of the same influences and liked some of the same movies and things like that. So for me, it was very easy to listen to people. And when I created that environment, it was a thing about, what do you think? Oh, you know, this person does this. And we can do it so many ways. That's the beauty of film. You know, you can do it so many ways. And then the thing is to not be so attached to just your way. People
right.
come up with things that are just really, you know, adorable. You know, the dog in the movie liked to lick people. You know, so when Joanna Cassidy picks up the dog, you're like, oh, God, this dog is going to lick her. She just loved that. It was really funny. So,
yeah.
you know, it's you want to capture that moment, you know. You're like, okay, I'm going to let the dog, you know. At first you're like, okay, we need to make sure this dog doesn't lick all over her. She's got to, but, you know, if she's not having a problem with it,
mm-hmm.
I don't have a problem with it. You know, it's those things. And just kind of, sometimes I think we think people are going to go in one direction, and they don't. You know,
yeah.
they go in, and those guys sort of set a nice tone for the movie. I think everyone admired them and admired their work, and they were team players all the way. You know,
mm.
no one was sitting in a trailer or anything like that. They were in there with everyone else, and I think that you learn from that. You know, you never know who's watching or who you're influencing.
Yeah.
As a person going into film.
And that's the beauty of a lot of independent films, I'm sure, is the sense of community and a common purpose, you know, to get the magic down.
Right.
Yeah. So to give our listeners an idea of Anderson's Cross, where did the idea originate from for you?
Well, for me, it was semi-autobiographical. And they say, you know, when you're writing, you're supposed to write what you know. And so I knew that I had had a pretty good experience growing up, and as I spoke to people, I could tell that it was sort of a unique experience. And I wanted to put that on to paper, you know. So I basically sat down and wrote down all of my favorite memories, and then took out the best ones and didn't write about those, and it's okay, I'll write about these right here, you know, and just sort of went that way. I was like, well, I can write a coming of age story. I can tell, you know, how I got to that place. I can put a really good African-American family to the forefront and be able to write from that. And
mm-hmm.
that was basically sort of how it came about. And a lot of the movies that I liked in the past were a lot of coming of age. I love that period in it, sort of in a young man's life. And,
yeah.
You know, so for me, that's kind of what I wanted to write about. And it's funny because when you're an actor or you're in show business, you're almost forced to always be a kid. It's, you know, and so it doesn't allow for you to sort of sigh into it. And for me, it's a constant coming of age here. I'm constantly
mm-hmm.
learning and having to experience new things and get along with different types of people. And, you know, and I'm constantly in areas that I've never been in before. And I just wanted to sort of write about that. And that's where it started. And I wasn't a trained writer, but I do love movies. And so
yeah.
for me, once I had a beginning, a middle, and an end, and if I knew where I wanted it to start and where I wanted it to end, I was like, okay, and I can do the journey from there and sort of capture this person.
In conceiving it, did you look to any other films to use as kind of a model of the feeling that you were going after?
Yes, there was a movie called Summer 42.
Yeah,
that I really liked a while ago. I liked American Graffiti. One of the things that I really wanted to do that I wasn't able to do it was to do it in sort of one day. I love movies like Ferris Bueller's Day Off and The Breakfast Club, you know. And
mm-hmm.
I was like, oh, just you know, I just think that it was beyond my reach at the time as a writer. But I love those types of movies. I was looking to try to put something in that effect. I knew that I wanted it to affect me, affect others the way like a movie like Terms of Endearment affected me. I knew I wanted people to laugh and cry and things like that. But mostly with the movies that I had in my head that I grew up watching, I stopped watching them while I was writing because you just want to, you know, and I've been able to go back and go, oh, okay, I see where I got that idea. I see where I figured out how I wanted to shoot that. But during the time frame, I was like, okay, well, let me sort of take a break from these movies that I continually watch all the time, you know. But nothing, Stand By Me, you know, this movie that sort of affected me, that showed the male characters and allowed them to cry and allowed them to feel pain and those things that just that aren't trying to be anything else. It's like this is a journey in the life of this person. This you're basically taking, a couple of months out of this person's life. You're just looking at what's going on in their life, and that's kind of what I did.
Yeah, you just mentioned the quintessential coming of age movies. All of those are. I'm interested to know when you're a triple threat like you are. Or a quadruple threat because you produce two. But how do you separate those duties? I mean, especially as a director behind the camera and an actor in front of the camera, is that a tricky balancing act for you?
It is, but I feel like when I'm getting ready to do a couple of more films, and the story is always first. Even with the producer, depending on the type of producer you have, if that is what attracted them to this, to put their money down, then the story is always first. So for me, I'm like that's truly the boss is the story. Everything that everyone decided to take a part in is all because of that particular script. And you have to sort of serve that. The thing is, the movie has to be better than the read because everyone has their own idea about what it looks like. And, they've sort of done their own sort of comic book in their head. So, you just have to make sure that the movie is better than the read because it's not a book. And so for me, when I'm thinking about things, I'm constantly aware that, we're spending someone's money and we have to stay on schedule and we have to get things done. But at the same time, I'm like, I've got to serve the story. So if I feel like something is going to take much longer, then the pre-planning of it that's where that comes into play. Like, we should have made sure we had enough time to shoot this particular scene. The other scene is okay. And not get crazy about things. It's like, oh, we have to shoot the door opening. Okay, well, then just shoot the door opening. I don't need 15 takes of that, even though people do, then I'm like, it's a door opening, Okay, that's it. So, those are the things. And the biggest thing is just learning not to yell cut, to just keep the mistakes. And to sort of everything has to be organic. They talk about it, but I didn't get it until I was on set. And then I was like, it has to be sort of a moment, and you're there to capture it. Mm-hmm. And that was the hardest thing because it was so in my head how it should be, And as an actor, and as a writer, I know the beats and things like that. But another actor has a different beat. And I have to let them do their job and not micromanage, or else it'll all come out to everyone acting like I would act. And that would be boring because then you'd have five characters doing the same. Those were the things that I sort of, for some odd reason, knew instinctively to do, and probably because I had watched so many other films and had been on so many sets,
And when you're taking it to the next stage, and editing the film, is it challenging not to lose perspective because you're so close to it and you're tinkering with it? And do you question, is this working or not? Is that a difficult process?
Yes. And I learned, you know, we were trying to deal with time constraints and things like that. I learned there was one scene in the movie that I was like, there's no way this scene can ever come out of the movie. This is just, everyone loves a scene, and there's just no way it can come out, you know. And, you know, finally I was just like, you know, I will try it. I will take it out. The thing is, once you do something and it's in someone's head and they see that it works, that's where you're stuck. But I was like, you know, I don't want to be a person that didn't listen. I don't know everything. You know, and so for me, I was like, I will try it. And that was the biggest thing. And when we tried to take it out, I missed it, but I don't think the movie missed it. Mm-hmm. And so it becomes those things where you're like, and that is, the editing was really hard because everyone sort of has a say unless you have final edit. I was very good to have our producer Michael Simmons was very good about letting me speak my piece and letting me see things and letting me sort of have a final say. Once you have someone that allows you to do that, then you should at least give them the benefit of the doubt when they say, "Hey, I think this is this." They're depending on you to make a great decision, you know, and so. There were a lot of things. We did a lot of test screenings and things like that, and those are hard, too, when people say, oh, you know, I didn't like this, and I love this, and and they make you rate things, and you're just like, you know.
Oh, that's got to be the most nerve-wracking experience ever,
test screening. Absolutely, absolutely. Oh. We had a test screening where, you know, we had gone to a couple of festivals, and we had won some awards, and so we had a poster, and we decided to have a test screening because we were still trying to cut it down. And, you know, on our poster had, like, you know, all of our awards and stuff like that. And there was some guy that was just livid because he just didn't believe we had won all the awards. He hadn't seen the movie, but, you know, he was like, wow, this is crazy, you know. But they can be nerve-wracking, and sometimes you think you know what people are going to connect with, and they connect with something completely different, you know. Mm. Everyone connected to the Trevor character. Mm. Everyone loved that Trevor, you know. And for me, I wished we had more of him, you know. It was just one of those things where I was like, wow, this was the part of the movie that I thought was going to be a little bit hard for people to sort of swallow here, and instead that's what they connected to. So you never know, and you go okay, well, let me sort of point it in that direction, let me get to him sooner, you know, let me figure out where this is going. This is so important to this particular character. And then there's some things you can't change at all, you know, because, you know, someone dies and people don't want that person to die. You can't do. You're like, well, sorry, can't. You know, I don't want to give it away, but you're like, oh, sorry, can't change that. You know, but that's great. It's very gratifying to see, you know, to have the lights come up and, you know, see people grabbing their tissues and hearing people crying.
Yeah. You're in production on your next film already, aren't you?
Yes, two of them, actually. One is a smaller film. It's called Hostage Diner, and it is about these people that are taken hostage, and then they kill the bank robbers and decide to keep the money. And that's a dark comedy, and we're shooting that in Canada. I know. And then I have another one that's shooting in March that's substantially larger, and it's called Prep School, and it's about these kids in a preparatory school, and it's stars Charlie McDermott and Evan Ross and Troy Hatton. We're very excited about that, and that's going to be a lot of fun to shoot. And
when you look at the films that you're making and the material that you're writing, what kind of career do you want to build? Do you have an idea of what your particular voice is, or is that a constant discovery for you?
I think it's a discovery for me. I can see that I have an issue with suppression, and it's coming out in my work. you know, and sort of the results of suppression and how that can sort of affect society and things like that. And I'm noticing sort of that theme, but that's just where I'm at sort of right now. Like, you know, that's what I'm what's coming out in my work. I'm hoping that I'll have plenty more experiences and it will sort of lead me to something else. But I do like just enjoying movies sometimes. But it's for me, I was just talking to my manager because, you know, he's like, just write something light. Just write it. You know, just give me something that's just, you know, that I can put anywhere. You know, and I, you know, I tried to write something light, and I thought it was pretty light, you know, and he's like, oh, this still has some you know, issues hidden in it, but it's good. So I'm like, okay, all right, well, there we go.
Movies. Yeah.
Yeah, so, it's crazy because I like everything, so I'm not a person that just likes one sort of type of movie. I mean, my favorite film director is Steven Spielberg. You know, I love Steven Spielberg. I love the stories. I love the way he tells them. You know, so for me, it's just a thing of just that's what I'm writing right now. But I'm definitely having a problem with people sort of pushing their ideas onto another person just to sort of make them smaller. And that's kind of a... That seems to be sort of where I'm at. And if I can tell that or show the results of that in a story, you know, people can just do so much if you allow them to shine.